You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 12th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We're live from Studio One at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme.
Bosnia and Herzegovina is showing that it can deliver on its membership criteria and on its citizens' aspirations to be part of our family.
The European Commission recommends Bosnia and Herzegovina start accession talks to join the European Union. We'll ask whether EU actions will match the words. After that, we'll head to the Netherlands for an update on a country without a government. We'll get a business update with Ewan Potts, and then...
According to the statistics that UN Habitat has, we would need to be building around 96,000 new housing units a day in order to bridge the housing gap.
We'll speak to the head of UN Habitat about a global housing shortage facing cities at the annual real estate conference MIPIM. We'll also get a fashion news update from Monocle's own Natalie Theodosi. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. For much of the past 2 years, the talk about which country might next join the European Union has focused on Ukraine, which is at war with Russia and pushing for EU accession to signal its firm tilt to the West. But that has left other countries that have long sought EU membership fading into the background. Today that changes as the European Commission recommends that Bosnia and Herzegovina begin accession talks to join the 27-nation EU bloc. Well, joining me now is Guy Delaunay, Monocle's Balkans correspondent. Guy, thanks for coming on the show. This has been a very long time coming, hasn't it?
A really long time coming. Can I take you all the way back to 2003, Chris, which is when we had the Thessaloniki Declaration by the then member states of the European Union, at which time, 21 years ago, they said they wanted all the countries of the Western Balkans, all the countries of the former Yugoslavia, in the European Union. Well, 21 years later, we had Croatia join in 2013. They don't like to call themselves Western Balkan anymore. And that's pretty much been that. Everybody else has been either stuck in accession talks, which have been going on forever, or stuck in the waiting room to start accession talks. Bosnia very much in the latter group, and hoping now to move beyond the waiting room and into that, I suppose, period of purgatory when these talks go on forever. I'm such a cynic, I apologize.
Well, I do want to touch on that and where the cynicism comes from, whether it's misplaced or not. But actually, just a question before that, when you mentioned Croatia, I'm just curious how even Bosnia has looked at that, the fact that Croatia got to join. How did that kind of change the dynamic in the Balkans that one country was able to join and the others not?
So Croatia joined in 2013, and that was a reward for being, first of all, something which several countries in the region have not been, which is a functional country, a functional democracy. It's not perfect, Croatia, but it was able to convince the European Union that it had made the reforms necessary to join the European Union. If we look at when Croatia started on its accession path in the 2000s, it took more or less 10 years for it to join. Serbia was in no condition to start negotiations there. It was barely out of the Milosevic era. Bosnia and Herzegovina, as people will well know, is a terrible mess of its own unique sort. Kosovo, still not recognised by 5 EU member states. Macedonia, as was, in an intractable dispute with Greece over the name of the country. So, you know, all of these things were adding up to none of them being ready. Croatia, on the other hand, didn't have those sort of disputes. It was able to get its act together and able to convince Brussels that it could put through those reforms. What that does, in essence, is it shows to the rest of the countries in the Western Balkans that if you do get your act together, if you are able to go through the European Union accession process, clear all these chapters which detail the reforms that the EU wants you to make, then it can be done. But it's not a simple matter, and it takes a lot of political will. And frankly, it's getting more complicated all the time. And that's before we even get to the question of whether there's really an appetite for expansion among the existing EU member states.
So tell us more about Bosnia and Herzegovina then in that context. They were granted EU candidate status in 2022. And to your point about kind of how far countries can come, Ursula von der Leyen, who we heard from at the top of the show, said in her move to recommend accession that they had made more progress in a year than in the previous decade. Is that true in your mind?
It's true-ish, I would say, actually. I mean, we've seen quite a lot of differences in the past year. The first is that the Bosnia and Herzegovina actually formed a national government, and governments in both of its regions, the Federation and Republika Srpska, relatively quickly after elections. I mean, we've gone entire cycles between elections without having functioning governments sometimes in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So to actually have functioning governments on both the national and regional levels, that was an achievement in itself. But then what's been going through since then has been quite notable. There's been, for example, an agreement with Frontex, the EU's border agency. There have been reforms put through on a national level on things like conflict of interest, money laundering, and the finance of terrorism. So those were things which were demanded by Brussels as a condition for Bosnia and Herzegovina getting the green light to start accession talks. It's kind of delivered. There's still laws on the judiciary which are meant to go through, but it seems to be that the European Union is saying, or at least the Commission is saying, well, you know, you've shown willing, you've done quite a lot, so in order not to set us back down the path of despair, let's give you the green light.
So speaking of that despair, then, this is the point, Guy, where we lean into your cynicism, but talk about the accession talks and really what this process will involve for Bosnia. Are they optimistic about the process and now that it's getting underway?
It's quite interesting, the reactions we've been getting from Bosnia, from the politicians of all the ethnic groups, that's Bosniaks, Croats and Serbs. They've all received this positively. I mean, the one which will amuse people who follow events in Bosnia closely will be the reaction of Milorad Dodik, who's the ethnic Serb leader, the president of Republika Srpska. And he's actually said that it's a positive signal, and it's an achievement of a great national goal for the Serbian people, that they were looking forward now to the life of Serbs in an economic and political space without borders. And he believes that Republika Srpska should be congratulated for everything it's done to achieve this recommendation by Ursula von der Leyen, which is very amusing because Mr. Dodik is, of course, the most disruptive person in the Western Balkans. There's some competition for that title, but he's a clear leader. He's under US sanctions for threatening the unity of Bosnia and Herzegovina and his closeness to Moscow, among other things. So for him to be saying with a straight face that he's been the one who's really contributed to Ursula von der Leyen making this announcement is very amusing. But he's in favour, the Croats are in favour, and the Bosniaks are in favour. And, you know, it's quite something when you get three different ethno-political groups all speaking out in favour of what's happening at the same time. That's quite something for Bosnia, and that is where we can, you know, be a little bit optimistic about things. We're allowing that little chink of optimism to come through, Chris. I think when you get the three groups agreeing on something at the same time, why not celebrate that?
Well, then just finally, Guy, and quickly, even with that optimism, though, is there a genuine hope and sense within Bosnia and, for that matter, of the other Balkan countries that want to get into the European Union that the EU is actually open for this?
So the EU has been notably engaging a bit more over the past couple of years. I think the war in Ukraine has concentrated minds in Brussels and within the member states. And they're aware that in the Western Balkans, there are strong links, particularly to Russia, but also China has been very active in the Western Balkans as well. And they're aware that if the European Union isn't involved, other people will step into the vacuum. And now there's money on offer, 6 billion euros for starters for this Western Balkans growth plan, which is meant to help those countries harmonize their systems with the European Union and provide genuine improvements to their infrastructure and other aspects of people's lives. So that's all on offer, as long as those countries make reforms. And if Bosnia and Herzegovina can get a document from the EU telling them exactly what reforms they've got to make and what goals are meant to hit at particular points, that sets out a path of reform for Bosnia and Herzegovina. And that gives hope to Bosnian people who've been leaving in their tens of thousands every year because they haven't been seeing a future in the country.
Thanks very much, Guy. That was Guy Delaney. Now here's Lillian Fawcett with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The first aid ship bound for Gaza has set sail from Cyprus as part of a pilot project to open a new sea route for aid. The Open Arms is carrying almost 200 tons of food for a population on the brink of famine as fighting between Hamas and Israel continues. Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry has resigned amid escalating gang violence in the Caribbean nation. Henry had held the position since the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. And Ukraine has begun talks with US and European aviation regulators about restarting direct flights to the country for the first time since Russia invaded in 2022. Kyiv's reconstruction minister also confirmed that his department was consulting with Israel's civil aviation authority. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Lillian. Now to the Netherlands, which remains without a government since November's parliamentary election that saw the far-right Geert Wilders party take the most seats. Coalition talks have been extremely painstaking for the last few months, highlighting a pretty common problem for many European countries at the moment as far-right groups make major gains, but none of the more centrist parties want to work with them. Wilders' party for Freedom has been locked in negotiations with three other parties, and a report is due to Parliament this week on whether any kind of government is feasible. Well, Shanae Bozetash is a journalist based in the Netherlands. She joins me now. Shanae, the four parties have kind of locked themselves into a country house, as I understand, this week. What is the latest?
Well, it looks as though there are some positive noises. One of the major parties, the VVD, which is Mark Rutte, our current Prime Minister's party, has made positive noises that there might be a parliament government by the summer. And they seem to be talking now about a kind of experiment, actually, in Dutch parliamentary life, an extra parliamentary cabinet, which doesn't necessarily sound like it'll be extra fun or extra good. It certainly sounds like it'll be extra difficult to work with. But essentially, that possibly Wilders may not even be prime minister. And that the parties would put forward different cabinet ministers, but there might also be experts from outside public life invited into a cabinet. Because the basic problem that Wilders has is he has this massive party of MPs, all of whom have diddly squat experience. And it's very difficult to see how you could form any kind of cabinet with the people that he's got on offer.
And why would Wilders himself be inclined to agree to that? Is this something that would be just sort of thrust upon him, the idea that he cannot be prime minister, despite the fact that he, of course, did get the most seats in parliament at the election?
Sure, he got the most seats, but he also didn't get the most support of the country. He has 25% of the votes in the November election, which, yes, makes him the largest party in a very split system, but it's by no means a huge vote. So he absolutely has to work with other people to make any kind of workable government. He is using the threat of the fact that he's gone up in the polls since to try to push this through and make sure that a right-wing government comes in. But he can't do it on his own.
And if he can't do it on his own, which party in your mind then kind of has the most power at this point, even if they are not the largest to push through either its sort of technocratic cabinet as you're talking about? Is it in that sense the centre-right groups like the New Social Contract that are sort of the kingmakers here?
Yes, I think you've hit the nail on the head. The NSC is the absolute party on which this all pivots, not least because the head of this party, Pieter Omtzigt, is a hugely popular MP who brought to light our childcare benefits scandal, a bit like the post office scandal, but multiply it by 1,000 and you've got the scale of the issue and also a kind of racist element in it. So Omtzigt is a really popular figure. And he has always said, I don't want to support a Wilders cabinet. And he's held firm to that stance. And there's been quite a lot of negative reporting about him in the Netherlands, that he's walked out of meetings and been emotional. Well, yeah, I think he said the same thing from the start, and he seems to be holding to what he said. And also, his party is not all far right. There is a bit of a spectrum in the MPs in his party that are more liberal. So what he will support is key.
And what is your sense then of what Wilders and his party, kind of how this is impacting them? I mean, are they going to sort of try to moderate some of their positions in order to get into any kind of government, even a sort of technocratic one? Or are they going to, you know, lean into, their election pledges, kind of stick to their guns and hope that maybe the next time around in an election, they can just say, well, we didn't get the government we wanted. This time we're going to get a properly far-right government.
Well, the hilarious thing about it all is that Wilders was one of the parties who didn't ask for his election programme to be totted up as to whether it made any kind of sense whatsoever. So all of the things that he's promised are completely unpayable. And nobody has, well, one retired academic has taken a look at all of the party programmes and done his own kind of tot up. And Wilders would leave us with the most extreme illegal budget shortfall of all of them. He's already had his MPs sit out of various debates and not take a point of view, for example, on lowering pension age. So it's quite interesting to see how he'll play this. He has to, at some stage, face up to the contradictions in his programme that he makes promises that just aren't achievable.
Well, and just finally, Shanai, before we let you go, Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, met with Wilders yesterday. Wilders, of course, has called for the de-Islamification of the Netherlands. He's also said that the protests against Gaza are anti-Semitic. What came out of this meeting?
Well, Herzog's arrival in the Netherlands was hugely controversial because he was invited to the opening of our National Holocaust Museum, which is a different story and a long story of denial 80 years after the war the Netherlands is facing up to its history, where three quarters of the Jewish population were murdered. And then there were a lot of protests about the coming of Herzog from people who felt that they wanted to protest against Israel's position in Gaza and the war in Gaza. Wilders met with Herzog, but he also took the occasion to launch into some Twitter attacks of the mayor of Amsterdam for supposedly supporting these protests. So much so that the MP, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, censured Wilders publicly. It's difficult to know what to make of it all. The one thing we can note is that Wilders cannot keep his fingers away from Twitter. And whether that makes a good president or not in a tiny little country like the Netherlands that depends on the rest of the world and is not America is a pertinent question.
Shanai Bostash, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. This is The Briefing and I'm Chris Chermak. It's time now to get the latest business headlines with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, let's start with an intervention from a certain former U.S. president named Donald Trump in the debate around the social media platform TikTok. What's he said?
Hello, Chris. Yeah, legislation to force TikTok's Chinese parent to sell it or face a ban in the U.S. has been picking up speed in Congress with broad support from both political parties. The bill was introduced last week, and it seeks to block app stores and internet service providers from offering the social media platform unless TikTok's Chinese parent company ByteDance sells it within 6 months. The bill got a boost last week with the Energy and Commerce Committee. They voted by 50 votes to zero to approve it. But the former president has weighed in on the matter. Donald Trump, much to the surprise of pretty much everyone, saying that there are a lot of young kids on TikTok who will go crazy without it. He was speaking to CNBC. He says that the thing I don't like is that without TikTok, you can, quote, make Facebook bigger. And I consider Facebook to be an enemy of the people, along with a lot of the media. So a surprising intervention from Donald Trump, who previously opposed TikTok and called it a puppet of the Chinese government, something they have vehemently denied. Of course, that leaves Republicans in Congress with a rather nasty dilemma. And I think if the election goes Trump's way in November, then they probably need to get used to more of this.
Well, Ewan, just to follow up on that, does that mean that markets need to get used to more of this as well? I mean, can they reckon with a Trump presidency in that sense, or is there just going to be so much uncertainty about what his positions are on companies and how they affect the markets?
Well, I suppose a Trump presidency is kind of a known unknown, isn't it? We have at least had a 4 years of this before. So I remember covering the markets during the Trump presidency, and some of the things he said made a lot of headlines, as you'll remember, you know, outside of markets as well. And markets did, in a way, kind of get used to the uncertainty. So some things really did roil markets. They really concerned investors. But other things, I think, were batted away as kind of just Trump being Trump. And I think, obviously, Trump's rhetoric is less measured than any other politician we could probably name in recent years. But I think once you get used to those things coming on a regular basis, then I think markets start to take it in their stride. So I think they'll be looking at the broad thrust of policy direction. And we know that he's going to be hawkish on China. Indeed, President Biden has been hawkish on China. That relationship, that trade relationship between the world's two biggest economies is already fractured. And I think that's probably not going to mend anytime soon. So I think it's one of the key things which investors will be focused on. As to the other parts of Trump's plans, I think those are becoming apparent. Perhaps we won't know about those until, if it happens, that election and next year.
Ewan, just one other story quickly to follow up on. There's been a development in the sale of the Telegraph newspaper here in the UK.
Yeah, Chris, this is a story which involves the United Arab Emirates, where I am at the moment. It's the ongoing debate over the future of the 175-year-old Telegraph newspaper and its sister publication, The Spectator magazine. Now, they're being sold by Lloyds Bank, who seized them after the previous owner got into some financial trouble, and the bank would dearly like to get rid of them. Now, towards the end of last year, an Abu Dhabi-based investment vehicle agreed to loan money to the Barclay family to take control of the Telegraph Group. But that proved very controversial with British MPs. They're not happy at foreign ownership, and particularly they're not happy at foreign ownership involving a region that's not known for its press freedoms. We'll roll on to today and the Bloomberg scoop. We understand that Rupert Murdoch's News Corp and the owner of the Daily Mail newspaper have held talks about a potential joint takeover of the Telegraph. Now, the Abu Dhabi-based fund would still be involved, but crucially, this would involve a much smaller stake, perhaps as little as 25%. And presumably, the hope would be that this would pass muster with the concerned politicians. Now, Bloomberg's approached all three parties for comment. The UAE investment company says it has not been involved with any talks. News Corp and the company behind the Daily Mail have declined to comment. So we'll have to watch out if a bid from perhaps the world's most famous media tycoon appears over the coming weeks.
Rupert Murdoch always finds a way to get himself in the news. Ewan, thank you very much. That was Ewan Potts in Dubai. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, around 20,000 people are expected to gather in Cannes this week in France for the international property festival MIPIM, which kicks off today. More than 460 speakers, including Thailand's current prime minister and Finland's former prime minister, will be exploring the key issues facing the real estate and construction sectors, from climate change to shifting demographics. On Monday, the festival hosted a pre-summit dedicated to housing and the shortages facing many cities. In attendance was Mihal Mlinar, the United Nations Assistant Secretary General and the Acting Executive Director of UN Habitat, that's the UN's Cities Agency. He spoke to Monaco's Carlotta Ribello about the current scale of the problem.
2.8 billion people are affected by different forms of housing inadequacy. Out of those, about 1.1 billion reside in slums or in informal settlements globally. And of course, that number is forecast to rise maybe to more than 3 billion by 2030 if we don't start working on relevant and appropriate solutions.
We know that more and more people will move to cities. Our urban areas are exponentially growing. What are some of the ways that cities can go about addressing this? And it's not something where one solution fits all.
Exactly. We now have around 57% of the global population that lives in the urban areas. And that is increasing. By 2050, it is estimated to be close to 70%. So the challenge is obvious. Around 3 billion people will need adequate housing by 2030. And we will get additional 2.5 billion people that will be moving into the cities newly. And of course, it is largely too often young people, especially in Africa and Asia. So we have to address it in a comprehensive way. It's not only about building new housing units. Obviously, this is one of the important solutions because, again, according to the statistics that UN Habitat has, we would need to be building around 96,000 new housing units a day in order to bridge the housing gap. But, we are mentioning that number not because we expect that this is realistically happening anytime soon, but to realize the scale of the problem and to be able to start doing something about that. And we need to design solutions collectively. At UN Habitat, we focus a lot on urban planning and urban policies and on advising the national governments on those. And we have really seen recently a lot of traction, especially in Africa and Asia, from the side of the national governments to do more, to have better urban policies, better legislature, to look for sources of funding. But we can only do it if we join forces, because national governments may be good at what I have already mentioned, the policies, the legislature, and providing at least part of the financing. But then we need to involve local and regional governments, mayors, governors of provinces, that of course really living on a day-to-day basis with the people that they serve, but also the private sector and other key actors in these solutions. We cannot bridge the gap without the private sector.
Staying on that point, but also taking a step back to that number, you said it's 96,000 units a day that would have to be built to address that. But even in the utopian scenario that was even achievable, then comes this social aspect that you were just talking about. Even if all those units were delivered, until other issues about living together in a city are addressed, creating a community, creating a neighborhood, if those are not put in place as well, you still continue to have these social issues of loneliness, of perhaps the postponing of starting a family because there's no, kindergartens or support services for people to focus on their careers. So even in the utopian scenario of building all those units, there's all these other aspects that have to contribute to create a functioning urban environment.
Yes, that's right. We have a lot on our plate. But again, I think we need to face the reality fully and of course, design comprehensive solutions. Especially in Africa and in Asia, we have in recent years been able to support different governments with organizing their national urban fora. It has proven to be a particularly useful and relevant and successful platform for bringing together all the various actors that contribute to solving let's say the urbanization challenges and the housing challenges. And through conversations that they are having with one another, we have seen really some great acceleration of prioritizing these things, of prioritizing building not only housing units, but building green cities, safer cities, more sustainable cities, also addressing the land issue, which of course is often a limiting factor. And in different countries, of course, there are different practices or different limitations. And again, there is no one size fits all, but the urban fora, national urban fora, is a particularly useful vehicle for having those conversations. We have seen, for example, in Kenya, where UN Habitat is headquartered, that they have been able to accelerate the building of housing units, but not somehow in an isolated fashion, but in an integrated fashion, in at the same time addressing climate or environment issues or other socioeconomic issues, because building housing units without taking into account future economic opportunities, transportation, education, health, simply doesn't make sense, because you would be taking a quick fix which could then potentially in a very short period of time backfire. My advice certainly also to those who are kind of confused or overwhelmed is to bring together all the various actors, including the private sector, the professional organizations of architects, of urban planners, and to have those conversations and to design the urban policies based on that. You cannot design urban policies, let's say from the national government or from the local government. There has to be a conversation happening among really all different players and actors in the national context, but also in the regional and local context.
That was Michal Mlinar in conversation with Carlotta Ribello at MIPIM. And finally, on to this edition of The Briefing, let's look at some stories from the world of retail with our fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi, who joins me here in studio. Good afternoon, Natalie.
Good afternoon.
We have a sort of restructuring roundup is what I feel like we're almost doing on this show. A lot of retailers have been kind of closing stores, fighting insolvency, starting with Matches Fashion.
Exactly. It's been a few months, and especially in the last few weeks, of sad news for the world of luxury retail. Matches Fashion, I mean, it started in the 80s as a small boutique in Wimbledon by a couple, Tom and Ruth Chapman, and it was really beloved for its point of view and for its curation. But over the years, I think it tried to scale up too quickly, relied on e-commerce too much, and after its sale to Apex Partners, the exit of the Chapmans, it lost its ways. And you add lockdown and the impact of lockdown on these businesses as well, and things did go wrong. Sadly, it was sold just before Christmas last year to Frasers Group, which owns Flannels, JD Sports, and they are trying to venture into luxury a lot more. But last week they realized that it's going to take too much for the business to be restructured and saved. So they filed for administration, and just yesterday they announced that they've laid off 273 people. So it was such an important company within fashion. They took a lot of bets on young designers and of course a lot of talent, from photographers to buyers to writers, worked within that ecosystem. So it's impacting the whole industry.
And so they sort of tried and failed in a way to lean into luxury. And then you look at a number of others. There's Yoox Net-a-Porter is looking for a buyer. Farfetch is in restructuring. Moda Operandi in the US is struggling to fundraise. We talked about Macy's on this show last week. I mean, what is going on here? What does all this tell you?
I think this is telling us that these businesses try to do too much too quickly. In the case of Farfetch, for example, they had a great model, marketplace model, which allowed independent boutiques from all over the world to list their products on the Farfetch platform and reach a much bigger global audience. So it was a great business model to begin with and widely successful up until a year or two ago. But having seen that success, they've also tried to acquire e-commerce media companies. They've tried to acquire clothing and manufacturing companies like the New Guards Group in Milan. They've acquired Browns, a boutique in London, and it just got too big. They were trying to do too many different things, and the bubble very quickly burst after a while. In the case of Yoox Net-a-Porter, again, I think it was such a pioneer when it started, but they've tried to onboard too many brands. There was too much product. They ventured into homeware, into contemporary clothing, some luxury clothing, beauty, activewear. So it was just too much all at once. And a bit, I think that's where greed comes in, when you see a good thing and you try to scale too quickly. So I think this, we're seeing the consequences of all of that across all the different companies that are now trying to raise funds, to restructure, to find new buyers.
So what does that mean in your mind? Is it about kind of going back to basics, doing what you do best? I mean, you've been researching all of this also for a story in Monocle's March issue, which kind of gets into this debate about the luxury sector in particular. Is there some kind of optimism there in the retail sector, particularly in fashion, despite all of these restructurings and challenges of getting too big, too greedy?
Absolutely. And I think that's what came out from that debate story that we did for the March issue, where we had buyers, investors, consultants kind of come together and share their own points of view. What people said is that there is an opportunity to return back to specialty retailers. So people that do one thing, they do it really well, they have a loyal audience, and they have a point of view. You don't try to do everything and please everyone. And I also think there is a big opportunity internally for the industry to restructure and to rethink its ways. A lot of the problems arose from the way that these retailers were doing business. They would place big orders, they would not pay upfront, and they would sometimes return unsold stock to the designers. So the brand, the designer, sometimes young independent designers, had to absorb the risk and all the costs for production and for having presence in these platforms or in the stores. And it was very unhealthy, and it's why a lot of these brands do not want to work with them anymore, and they are trying to build either their own shops or their own smaller e-commerce platforms, because they've been burnt in the past. They did not receive payment, they had to produce collections and then just have them returned. So it goes to show that retailers especially, but all across the industry, they need to think about doing business in a better way and build long-term partnerships.
Well, then just finally on that, are there brands in your mind that are doing that well, that have leaned back into this specialty kind of that they offer?
In terms of retail, people that are doing, I think the department stores have been investing a lot and have built more trustworthy relationship with the brands. We're just generally seeing a return to the physical space. So I would really kind of look at how they are working with the brands. And sometimes they do one-off partnerships. They work together to create different types of pop-ups and concepts that also entertain the customer. I think that's great. But I'm also really looking forward to seeing smaller independent boutiques. We've lost them a little bit during the pandemic, but all around the world, I think there will be a return, and we'll see the designers and the brands either work in their own retail channels or partner with people that they share interests and points of view, and hopefully a big return into those specialty boutiques that we all used to know and love.
Natalie Theodosi, Monocle's fashion editor, thank you very much for joining us. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Lillian Fawcett. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'll be hosting then as well. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.